once more into the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And let's see what else I got to say on here. The Personal Wealth Coach is not only a radio program, which you probably have concluded from the fact that we just said it was, but it is also...
Wait, they probably knew it without us even having to tell them. I bet
they knew. Well, I said they already figured it out. I mean,
I bet they figured it out when they turned on their radio.
Turn your radio
okay,
on.
All right. It's also... I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
Just listen to... Okay.
Now I started a song.
It's also the name of a registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, based in Salado, Texas, that offers objective fiduciary investment advice and management to people of higher net worth, registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. That's our primary regulator, which is the opposite of the moderators and has to do with the Lincoln County War somehow. I don't know which side Billy the Kid was on that. Do you know?
I don't.
Was he a regulator or a moderator?
I think he was a regulator.
Well, that would explain
it. But I'm not positive. I could look that up.
Make you famous. And the information we present on this radio program is not, should not, and could not, would not be used as investment advice. Instead, it is educational. Investment advice is given to people on an individual basis based on their individual situation. The information we present is we have obtained from sources we believe to be accurate and factual, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the completeness, accuracy, or anything else about the stuff we talk about, stuff being a technical term. Which takes us right into the fact that if you want to call in, and this is presuming that it is the 24th of February, which is this is our last program in February of 2018, and we should cry a little bit over that. If today is the 24th of February where you are of 2018, you're certainly welcome to give us a call at 773-1400. That's area code 254-773-1400 with any questions, thoughts, or comments you have about anything to do with the economy or investing. That's our areas of expertise. Please do not ask us any questions or include anything that has to do with team sports because we are blissfully ignorant. And
well,
we do have
you can ask. You're just going to display our ignorance for the world.
Yes, and we do have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. Is there any simple way of explaining the extreme volatility that we've been experiencing in the last 3 or 4 weeks? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thanks.
Any simple way?
Simple answer, no.
Well, first up, a couple of things.
There
Number
is
one,
a simple answer. But
the,
yeah.
the volatility really, I think you'd have to really stretch your imagination to call this severe because, I mean, it barely dipped down to 10% in the drop, and then it came back up about half that amount. What happens in the market is irrational exuberance eventually takes over. And if you actually look at the way the market has run up, and if you ran a trend line along it, and we've done this around the S&P 500, you will discover that we're just back on the trend line, a rising trend line, mind you, but we're back on the trend line. And what happened was around the beginning of January with the passage of the new tax bill, there was some speculation and people started jumping into the market. And we saw a lot of retail investors go from being very much afraid of this stock market to be very much in love with it and rushing in, and the prices started. And once they start up, people buy it because it's going up. And sometime around the end of January, it began to sink in more and more places that all of the wonders of the tax cut might not be quite as wonderful as they thought they were because it was generating inflation, because we saw some inflation reports that suggested we're going to have inflation around 3% this year. And the Federal Reserve then, by definition, would start raising interest rates, which would pull all that money back out of the economy. And there's another couple of things that went in there, too.
What's really more commentable, in my opinion, is the lack of volatility. I know that people are talking about the extreme volatility, and it's a difference from what was going on just a month ago or 2 months ago that we had this kind of smooth ride. When you look at the words of the president and you use the same words for any other president in the past, we would have market volatility that is extreme. So let's kind of take a step back. What we've got here is that hyperbole is used a lot more in the political world. They're using words like most and always and biggest. And it's not just the president, but the president sets the tone. And if someone says biggest tax cut in history or largest fill in the blank, if the president in the past had said that, we would have said not presidential. We've got a kind of a new definition of what presidential is. And the market is still getting used to that. The fact that it's gotten used to it enough that we don't have the kind of huge swings back and forth when the president is talking about tariffs, walls, that sort of thing, the market's kind of used to it and says, we'll see what happens. That's been the case when we've talked about major legislation, whether it's immigration, tax reform, kind of fill in the blank, the abolishment of an existing tax code, health code of Obamacare. Whether it's abolished or still in place, what happens next? The market's been very stable during those statements. When we have from an uninterested party, from the measuring folks, the folks that are the most uninteresting in the world because they don't have a lot of passion in their speech, and they say we're starting to see inflation. That's from a new source, and that's why we're seeing volatility based on this new source. This isn't someone getting elected. So the market took a lot more notice.
From strictly a rational point of view on this, and this is Jeff, and I'm telling you my conclusions here. Up until the beginning of January, the market inflows, the market rose because professionals were investing more money. And why were they investing more money? They were buying because corporate earnings kept coming in higher. And so at the end of December, we had a market that it was pretty much right on its historical, I guess is the right word, price earnings ratio for the long term. In other words, a fairly valued market. With the passage of the tax bill and a lot of news articles about the wonderful things that were going to happen and a lot of radio talk about the wonderful things that were going to happen following this tax cut, I think a lot of people who didn't know a whole lot about what they were doing rushed into the market and started buying and ran the price-to-earnings ratio up by the end of January to the point where the market was actually overpriced. Now, when sanity set back in, and the economists have been saying this all along, this additional money, first off, not as much of it is going to come back to the United States as you think. Secondly, what comes back is not necessarily going to create more economic activity in the United States. And third, to the degree that it does create all these economic doodads in the economy, the Fed is just going to have to raise interest rates and take the money back out of the economy. So there's kind of a consensus among the professional economists that follow the market and comment on the market that this tax cut may have very little effect on the economy or the market.
Now, throw in one final piece. So you've did three things having to do with the tax code. The fourth piece is that we moved beyond rhetoric and into action in putting tariffs on both an ally –
yeah.
And someone that we are actively competing against. That is the opening salvo. Tariffs don't stop at the first one. They just don't. There's nowhere in history, unless somebody else comes into power, that's the way it works. What happens is that the other country responds. And China's already floating ideas on what they're going to slap tariffs on. South Korea may not slap any tariffs on us. They really have a lot of thankfulness for us, and they're dependent on us for a lot of things. That doesn't mean that we should be slapping tariffs on them because they build better washing machines at the moment. So the idea of the trade war, the idea that the tax reform, we had a big reaction to the tax reform, and even people like us, I read the tax bill. And it was about 700 pages long, which is not as long as it sounds because it's one column. Tax law, any law, is not as long as it sounds by pages. It's one column. It's like a newspaper column long or wide, and it goes on and on. Most of it, though, is referring to existing places in the tax code. So you have to look all of that up and figure out what it means. So the implications of the tax code are still sinking in.
Yeah, and that's an after the, you know, we can come back to this.
He asked for a simple way of doing it. Simple answer is there isn't a simple answer.
Simply, earnings right now, based on the fact that we've got the vast majority of fourth quarter earnings in, year over year, corporate earnings have risen a little over 15%. Year over year from this point last year, the market is up about 16%. Well, when you throw in the fact that the corporations that have reported these earnings, and by the way, they're the most, they have risen above expectations more than any period before in history. In other words, we have about 78, I think, last time I looked, percent of the companies that have reported so far have reported earnings above expectations. Normally, it's like 60%. And they're reporting, they're stating in when they do their earnings reports that they anticipate higher earnings in the future, and that's the extra 1%. So it's, if we look at where the market is today, after running up, dropping, coming back halfway, and stabilizing over the last week, we have a fairly priced market today, and that's really a big good thing. But it was, by any definition, overpriced at the end of January. Now, it can get overpriced and stay overpriced a long time without a correction, but that's the point in a correction. The market corrected in actually a fairly rational fashion. It actually corrected for the people that got overly exuberant, and somebody said, whoa, this market is 5 or 10% too high. We need to sell some stocks. And once that started happening, the professionals who'd seen the market go beyond what they considered to be fair value started selling, and that created a stampede of selling. And when it hit bottom about the middle of the month, it was now back below its fair market value by most estimates, which means people started buying back in, and now we're stable. And don't expect it in the immediate future to run back up to where it was. I don't expect it will. It's a fairly valued market. Now the professionals at least, are focused on what effect is all this going to have on corporate earnings over the next year. And there's a lot, like Jake said, it takes a while for this stuff to sink in. Like, for example, there was a consensus at the beginning of the year, in the media at least, that a tremendous amount of money was going to flow home.
Yeah,
because the people would pay taxes on it.
Counting the numbers in the trillions of money that was just going to come right back to the United States because taxes were going to get paid on that. And so why wouldn't it come back? And
now the realization is beginning to set in.
Well, that money was doing stuff over there.
That the money, what happened was, the money's been flowing home a long time. It's one of the reasons the earnings in the stock market is up, is because what happened is, let's say Apple or whoever, whatever company, had a bunch, let's say they had $1 billion overseas and they invested it in bonds and they couldn't bring it home without a high tax burden. So what they did is they sold bonds in the United States at dirt cheap interest rates.
Yeah.
And when they sold the bonds, in essence, they used the overseas money as collateral to borrow money in the United States at a lower interest rate, and it was cheaper than paying taxes. So they've got these bonds outstanding in the United States, and they can't just make them go away. People hold those bonds. And so they've already spent the money, and it's sitting in bonds overseas, and it's sitting in, and they've got money borrowed in the United States, and it will take several years for that situation to unwind itself, and they will probably gradually bring some of that money in to pay off the bonds as they mature. But in many cases, they issued those bonds fairly long term because interest rates were dirt cheap.
Yeah.
Money's not going to come rushing back. It already has.
Last year, so this is kind of midway through the year, Apple sold $5 billion worth of 30-year maturity bonds at extremely low interest rates. And if you could get an interest rate on your mortgage at the rate that Apple got for these bonds, you would say, all right, let's do that. Well, So they got $5 billion, just some cash, so that they could pay dividends or whatever. At the time, they had about $230 billion in sort of short-term positions overseas. Not quite liquid, but not quite illiquid either. Not cash, but more like year-long bonds. And they didn't want to bring it back because, well, if you think about the interest that they're making on the bonds that they had overseas and the interest that they were paying on the 30-year bonds that they were selling to the public, they went to the public and say, loan us money. They're earning more interest on their cash positions than they're paying on the bond. Why would they bring the money back when they can just leave it there and make money on it while issuing new bonds?
And there was this assumption that it would jack earnings up when they brought the money back, and they'd be paying big dividends, or they'd be buying back shares. And then, you know, we reported on that. But it turns out that the surveys that we're getting now, several companies have independently done surveys of companies that are that have large cash holdings overseas or short-term bond holdings. Turns out the majority of them are planning to raise wages.
Right.
And let me tell you, that is that in other words, if they raise wages, that raises expenses for the company. That means their earnings tend to decline, not go up. And the second thing about raising wages, and it means that there is a shortage. We've been talking about the shortage of workers. They want to keep their workers. And once they get into a wage competition and start, and which is, by the way, what's going on right now, in the last quarter, we've seen wages at these same companies in the quarter go up 3%.
Yeah.
And that indicates that we could be on the verge of some serious inflation, which means that the Federal Reserve will have to raise interest rates, which means that
right.
earnings go down again.
So I want to kind of give some definitions out there. We've got pockets of very large inflation.
Very large pockets?
And they're not large pockets. They're relatively small pockets. In the old words of the Federal Reserve, it's frothy.
Oh.
We've got these bubbles, these pockets of inflation that are around the highest earning companies, their headquarters. And people say, what are you talking about? Bubbles of inflation around what that sounds
pockets.
Like some pockets of inflation that are forming around these headquarters of companies. And if you really want a easy definition of that, look at the prices for almost anything. Milk, green beans, real estate,
gasoline, diesel
in San Francisco. Not anywhere else, just in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And what you'll find is that the price of housing, the price of food, energy, basically almost anything you want to buy has gone up tremendously with the wages in that area. So when you hear about the wages being paid by these big tech firms and how it's a great place to work because the wages are so high, one of the drawbacks of those high wages is because so many people have high wages in those areas that it's not really high wages anymore. They have the equivalent wage of someone making much less money in a lower cost of living location. And the danger of raising wages across the board without increasing the value. So for instance, if you've got a job and you're just doing exactly what you did last year or the year before, and you get a wage increase, well, why are you getting a wage increase? I mean, shouldn't you be, you know, we talk about this on immigration. Isn't this a merit-based system? Shouldn't you get paid more for doing better? Well, that's kind of the idea. If the company comes into a lot of money, either because it doesn't have to pay taxes or it's able to bring money home from overseas, and they say, oh, we're going to increase wages, what that does is it creates a wage battle. A war between the different companies that are competing for the same people to raise those wages, which causes all the prices in the area where the wages are going up to go up as well, which causes anybody that isn't getting paid at that wage scale to leave the area.
And this is the areas that Jake's talking about have a tendency to lead the rest of the nation. Things
right.
that 10 years ago were new and modern and cutting edge in California are now commonplace across the United States,
right.
and whether we like that or not. And so there's a lot of a lot of observations that we are about to get into inflation, and the Federal Reserve has already said they're going to be raising interest rates, and bond rates started up. As a matter of fact, in the middle of this week, the 10-year Treasury, which for whatever it's worth, 18 months ago was trading had a 1% yield, hit 3%, and that indicates that the Treasury bond market. Well, that's 2.95 something, but close to 3%, is indicating that the marketplace, the bond marketplace, is and the people in it are anticipating that we're going to have higher inflation in the near future. And this is how and the other thing, Jake mentioned this, and it's very important to recognize the rest of the world is engaging in new free trade agreements. World trade is increasing dramatically, and the United States is talking about
isolation,
breaking off trade agreements, not getting into new ones, and starting trade wars, which means that which is why the dollar has declined. The dollar's down about 9% from where it was a year ago. Why? And with interest rates going up in the United States, normally dollars would fly in here to buy the higher interest rate treasuries. And instead, they're moving out. And the reason they're moving out is they anticipate that the United States will not do as well economically in the future as they have as it has in the past, because it's getting out of the trade business. And all those things together kind of sunk in at once,
causing the dollar to drop. It's causing inflation to come up.
And the dollar dropping, by the way, causes the price of oil to rise. You'll notice the price of oil and gasoline goes up in the United States recently.
We have talked a lot over the past probably 6 or 7 years about why we're not seeing inflation. You don't see inflation because you can't raise the prices of an American good because the competition overseas is going to have a lower price, so you'll just buy the lower price thing, whether that's in televisions or canned goods. It doesn't matter. If you raise the prices on the American side, the other side doesn't go up, so it keeps inflation down. Well, as soon as we start putting tariffs on other stuff, again, it's the same canned good or the same television if the price goes up. I'm going to give an example that just came out this week. So existing home sales. Did you see that number?
They're down.
Yeah, for January. So January housing starts increased by 9.7%. I talked about that last week as being a really, really impressive number. That's huge.
Yeah, I really want to see the numbers on housing stops,
though. Yeah, housing stops, I don't know how fast they move, though.
Right.
I think most houses just hold still. So housing starts, that's the beginning construction on a new home, went up by almost 10% last month, while at the same time, existing home sales declined 3.2%. So if you look at what we're seeing, sales are down versus a year ago. So basically against December, it was down 3.2%. That's not a good thing because December is usually a low month. Sales are down 4.8% versus a year ago. Now, why am I talking about this? Because it's a great example. Remember the number 4.8% decline.
4.8 with a minus sign in front of it.
The median house, median house price in January is up 5.8% versus a year ago. So a year ago, we had 4.8% more sales happening. We have since increased the prices by 5.8%, and we're surprised to see the sales dropping there. And there's a lot of thought that it's low supply. There's not enough existing homes for sale. That's not it. When we look at the inventory levels of existing homes, it's roughly the same as it was a year ago. So what we're seeing is that because houses have been selling, people have overraised the prices for their homes. That means the housing market is getting too hot. We're about to start shifting into a buyer's market. It's been a seller's market for about 3 years. We're about to start shifting. It's not going to be overnight. It should be over a couple of years into a buyer's market where there's too many houses for sale and the houses pricing is too high. And you're going to start seeing houses lower the prices. And part of that is the tax law.
Yeah, that's what I started to say. Because of the limitation on deductibility, particularly in states with state income taxes.
Yeah, and the upper mortgage levels.
And the states, you mentioned California, mm-hmm. the states with high state income taxes where they are going to get hurt the worst by the tax law are also the states that tend to have the highest housing prices across the board. So that, you know, we think about, okay, a $500,000 house is something uber special. Well, it's not in the Northeast and it's not in California or Washington.
It's kind of an average house, actually.
So the point is that because of the limitation on deductibility of the interest rates, because of a whole series of things that have gone on, we're going to see that side of things start to be depressed. And that's one of the very, very, very early signs that economic expansion is getting old. And the end of it is
it's still years away.
Right. As a matter of fact, and
we still have a lot of growth between now and then.
Yeah, we mentioned in the newsletter, Moody's Analytics is saying 2019 is either going to be, they're predicting the GDP growth to be much less than 1% and might go negative in 2019. 2020, they don't actually make formal forecasts into 2020, but they say the 2019-2020 range is where we're most likely to have the next recession. And so once all that stuff starts, the professionals start looking at it, they say, okay, earnings are going to get hit about 2019-2020. By the way, let me emphasize, we're not suggesting that you do market timing and think about bailing out of the market.
No, that just doesn't work.
Because there is literally no way to forecast when these things top and when they bottom. What you do is you set up a good portfolio, a well-balanced portfolio, and you ride it all the way through. That's the crucial thing to do. Nobody has successfully been able to time the market and come out ahead of the people who just do good investing and good allocation and ride through to date. And unless you're smarter than all the smartest people out there, you won't be able to do it either. So we're not suggesting you try to time it and bail out. But we are saying that some of these realities are starting to set in, and some of the professional investors became aware of this, which is why we saw a market correction. And by the way, I'm really glad to see this correction.
Me too. We were both happy to see it because it means that we can prolong the growth.
Yeah, and that's critical. What happened following 1994 to 2000, probably about 1997, 1998, it was clear to just about anybody who wanted to look that the stock market was overvalued as a whole. And
let's
people
be
just
clear,
kept buying.
We didn't think that the market was overvalued before the correction. So it was really not overvalued after the correction.
And in
94, yeah. They didn't have a correction. It was overvalued and then they didn't have a correction.
Well, actually did. We had a dip in 1994. We had a little correction. I remember it entirely too well.
I was saying 97.
Okay. 90.
Yeah.
And then, the Asian contagion came along in 1990. These things happen, but you're asking why we are returning to some volatility. It's because if you really wanted to give it a very simple answer, all these complicated answers are very important. But the simple answer is at the beginning of January, retail investors, normal, ordinary people in their 401ks and in their discount accounts or whatever, started pouring money into the market and shot the market up. And
then we had the correction, and retail investors dumped stuff out of the market.
And when as long as retail investors stay out of the market, there tends to be a great deal of stability as the professionals are in there. But once the retail investors get in, they tend to exacerbate the ups and the downs rather dramatically.
This is specifically to the caller. If you go to our webpage and listen to the programs at the beginning of the year in January, we made some statements for several weeks in a row that we were seeing money flowing into the market from retail investors. And we gave a warning. This is a great warning, and I'm going to wrench my shoulder out of socket, patting ourselves on the back in here. We said, expect volatility to go up. So the simplest answer is a lot of amateurs were getting into the market. And when amateurs get into the market, volatility starts up.
And when you should really get worried is when we could go in some more things on this, but we probably need to do commercials or something.
Yeah, it's about time for commercials. Thanks for that call. And I want to hit a very, very 3-minute short statement, maybe even 2.5 minutes. A study, I'm going to put that out there, a study came out, a paper in the journal Finance came out. It was co-authored by executives at Bank of America and JP Morgan Chase. Now, let me first precursor that by saying that's weird. Most of these papers are done by academics. There were some academics involved and co-authored the paper, but that's weird. And what they said was that quantitative easing did nothing for interest rates. And the Federal Reserve, several members of them responded of, no, it's just harder to measure than what you're doing. You can't look immediately after for implications of it. I'm going to rebut that. I know it's a weird thing. The size of the bond market is the easiest way to show the impact that quantitative easing has. Are you familiar? A bond market is bigger than the equity market. And the bond market in the United States,
lots bigger,
was right around $40 trillion. That's with a T, not a B, not an M. $40 trillion. That's a lot. The Federal Reserve, during its quantitative easing, was buying bonds off of the open market. And during the time that it was buying bonds, it took its balance sheet in bonds from about $600 billion before the recession to about $4.5 trillion with a T. $4.5 trillion. So that was $3.9 trillion that they bought. That's about 10% of the bond market. That had an effect on interest rates. There's no way that could not have had an effect on interest rates. And that's the easy – I like to go to the simplest thing and say if you buy 10% of anything, it's going to affect the price.
And prices are affected on the margin, and they change the margin dramatically.
And that was my end of statement there. We've got a caller coming in. We'll hit the caller before we go to commercial. Oh, we won't hit hard, I promise.
All right,
caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, I got a follow-up question. There's a front-page article this morning on the Journal about Buffett loads up on Treasury bills, and it says every Monday he buys $4 billion.
Uh-huh.
How much – I mean, again, complicated issue, but I assume that there's a fixed number of bills available, and how does he get in line up in front of everybody else, or how does that process work? I'll hang up on this.
Okay.
After the break.
He doesn't actually get in line in front of everybody else. There's certain primary treasury dealers and people with cash.
He's becoming one very quickly, though.
Yeah, I mean, there's literally primary treasury dealers that are designated by the Federal Reserve to be primary treasury dealers. They're the people that actually go to the treasury, buy the securities, and then sell them.
And that Mondays are averaging about $50 billion per week at the moment.
And as we mentioned last week, I don't know if we mentioned it, I don't remember whether we mentioned it on the radio program, but I think we did. But it was in the newsletter. The United States government this week and next week announced they will be borrowing, get this, $1 trillion.
Yeah.
And a lot of that is in short-term stuff. So it's not a matter of getting in line. It's a matter of finding enough buyers to borrow $1 trillion this week from the public.
And the other thing about that headline and everything else about it, anytime Warren Buffett is bragging about having too much money and there's nothing out there to buy, if you look back, just look at the archives.
Buying something.
Look at the archives. He'll say very loudly to everyone, there is nothing available to buy, while he's already halfway through the negotiations to buy a major company. So keep that in mind. He's a negotiating tactic.
It means he's found the thing he wants to buy and he can't find anything else.
Right. He's found the thing he wants to buy and he's negotiating the price down by saying there's nothing out there to buy.
Yeah.
So anyway, we got to play some commercials. Thanks for the call. We will be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to join in the conversation, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
I think it's there's a couple of noteworthy things in there. One is that over a 10-year period, he made a bet. Warren Buffett made a bet that he could – that the S&P 500 would beat a basket of hedge funds over a 10-year period, and he won.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're thinking about, man, I wish I could invest in a hedge fund and make the big bucks. Well, no, actually, hedge funds make big bucks for people who run them and not so much for everybody else.
Well, they have specific short periods of time that they've done really, really well, followed by longer periods of time that they don't do so well. So it's and the other piece of this is that Warren Buffett's purchases of U.S. Treasuries at $4 billion a week, roughly, is making him, it makes Berkshire Hathaway into a secondary trading desk. And this is a really, people don't understand a lot how the bond market works. So the stock market, you actually have a centralized location. There's a market and all of the things are listed on that market. And the bond market, you just have a lot of people that have been collecting things, collecting bonds, whatever issues of bonds, this period of time. And then when someone wants to buy a bond, bond traders have to pick up the phone and call all the different people or organizations that they know that have got a large number of those bonds. It's called making a market. And Warren Buffett in that article mentioned that people are now calling them to buy bonds. And there's a transaction cost that comes with that. And the transaction cost is one of the profit centers for Warren Buffett for Berkshire Hathaway. It's not a huge profit center, but they're making more than just the interest on the bonds because people are buying the bonds from them and then turning around and selling the bonds back to them because they know that they are still buying those bonds.
There's an interesting quote that I think is very, very insightful at the end of the article in the Wall Street Journal. From Warren Buffett, he said, and I quote, "Our bonds had become a really dumb investment compared to American equities," end quote. It's not to say that you should have 100% of your portfolio in equities, but one of the points he makes in there is bonds can be more risky than equities, and a lot of people don't understand that. And it's one of those key elements in building a portfolio is to recognize all the things that need to be in there. But one of the things that is worth recognizing, and he pointed it out, is the stock market as a whole has outperformed hedge funds. The American equities over the long term, depending on – there's different asset classes within equities. But in generally speaking, American equities are just, as a long-term investment historically, about as good as it gets in the world. And there's ways of regulating that, moderating that within one's portfolio, and I think it's very important. And it's also important to recognize that they sometimes take a nosedive and stay down for a while. But there's some deep wisdom there, and that these things all one relate to another. And by the way, he was unaffected. He like us was really kind of glad to see this a correction that it came through. Why was I glad to see a correction? Well, because the longer ago we go without a correction, the more severe the one is likely to have that comes on the tail end. And once we get a nice correction of 10% and the market comes back down to its fair market value, I'm a lot more comfortable. And but it also means if you're used to higher returns in equities in the recent past, you might want to get over that because I don't think we're going to see 15% earnings growth this year. And
if we see a 15% market growth without the 15% earnings growth, then we're talking about a market that begins to be overvalued.
Yeah, so that's all things to be aware of and rattling around in the back of your head. Telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. And you're welcome to give us a call and raise a subject. What do you got, Jake?
I got something interesting. It kind of touches on – it's almost the same as what I was talking about with Bank of America and J.P. Morgan Chase coming together and saying, look, it's the quantitative easing hasn't done anything. There's some motivation there on their part. Quantitative easing has kept interest rates down. That's not good for banks. Long term, banks want interest rates to be higher because that's how they make their money. Their profit is in adding to those interest rates whatever they want to charge to make their profit. And at this point, they can't charge a whole lot. So of course they're going to say quantitative easing didn't work. There's a another piece, but we've got a caller calling in, so we'll hit the caller and then we'll move on to this next statement. It's about biofuels and a refiner going out of business and saying it was because of the mandated biofuel policy of the United States. So we've got a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. And that caller's off the air with the Personal Wealth
Coach. That was interesting.
Yes, it's just a okay, so there's a biofuel policy. We're all aware of it even if we don't know that we're aware of it. When you go to fill up your car, on the pump, it says may contain 10% ethanol. This is from a decade and a half ago or so. Congress was looking at the price of oil going up and knowing that most of the oil we were purchasing was from overseas. And looked around, we're also aware of pollution issues and burning carbon-based stuff. And they said, okay, well, here's a solution. We'll put ethanol alcohol into the gasoline. So there's a big lobbying arm for the corn industry that talks to Washington all the time. And there's a big lobbying arm for the oil industry that talks to Washington all the time. Well, the oil industry at the time was smaller than its long-term history. It's because we weren't really pushing in the oil world as much as we are now. And corn was bigger than its historical norm as far as the industry goes. So they put through this law. And at the time, we looked at it and said, this isn't good. It costs more to make that ethanol. It's a subsidized thing. The government's putting money into it. We don't like it very much. Well, it's called the Renewable Fuel Standard. And it's got a growth curve in the law that's projected to go way up. And one of the problems with the law is eventually it goes to 20%, and most cars will not work with 20% ethanol. Well, a company, PES, it's a Pennsylvania, Philadelphia Energy Solutions. Philadelphia Energy Solutions. It's owned by another private company called Carlyle. It's an investment company. And Carlyle owns a bunch of other stuff. It owns rail stations and it owns all kinds of facilities out there. Well, PES, the refining company, was paying rent to Carlyle, its owner. So keep that in mind. It's paying rent to use a refilling station at a railway place. And it doesn't matter if they use the station. They have purchased the spot. So even if they're not there, even if they're not using it for anything, they've got to pay rent on it. So in essence, PES is paying its owners a rent check every month. PES is now bankrupt. Their claim is because it costs so much to get the biofuel, the ethanol, mixed into the refining process. It's cost them somewhere around $150 million over the past 5 years to put the ethanol in there. The rent check that they're paying to their owner has cost them about $300 million over the past 2 years. But the political side of this is getting involved in the market. And this is one of the areas I like free markets. I like markets that you can clearly see where's the money coming from and where is it going. What's the profitability of a company? If it's going bankrupt, what are the reasons why it's going bankrupt? And when the political arm is saying the reason why this company is bankrupt is because of a biofuel standard. Well, first off, you got to recognize I'm not a big fan of the biofuel standard. But it's an even playing field. All of American refineries, if they're going to sell gasoline in the United States, they've got to do it. So to say that they're going bankrupt while everybody else has got off the charts earnings, and they have, and saying it's the biofuel that's the reason, and they're doing it in a political way, it's more likely, in my opinion, that this is just a seed that's being used for politics so that they can say that there wasn't some kind of problem in Carlyle milking the milk from this particular refining cow until there was no milk left, and then starting to cut in on the meat while the cow was still alive, And then the cow doesn't make it. And so they turn around and say, well, it's the fault of the government. That's a problem, in my opinion. The fact that the government's involved and can be blamed is a problem. The fact that Carlisle is draining its goose that lays the golden egg. So now it's a goose and a cow. I'm mixing my metaphors. It's great. So they're milking the golden goose.
For the cow that laid the golden egg.
Right.
Okay, I got it.
So what's going on here is that this sounds to me very much like what Enron was doing. Because Carlisle, during that same time period, to its shareholders, was saying how much new earnings, new revenue it was making off of the rent payments being paid to it by a company that it owned. I think there's some problems there, guys. It's a little bit more complicated than the surface area of biofuel standards. And even when I don't agree with the biofuel standard, you still got to run your company like you expect it to live into the future. Okay, and on to you.
Okay, completely different subject.
We're not going to talk about cows and gooses anymore?
No, we're going to talk about the Securities Exchange Commission chairman.
All right.
Jay Clayton actually looks like he's going to do something, which is not like SEC chairman recently. He confirmed at a conference in Washington that the titles used by security salespeople and brokers are misleading. And he says he's going to take a look at that. And to give you an example, the very simple example, a broker who is a security salesperson in many companies has the title of financial advisor. And in fact, they're not any form of advisor. They're salespeople. And an investment, people generally don't know the difference between an investment advisor and a financial advisor. An investment advisor is an organization or person registered to offer objective, independent investment advice, and they're held to a fiduciary standard. Whereas a financial advisor is a salesperson whose job it is to sell you something that's not unsuitable for you, but generally the salesperson will tend to charge you the most money that they can legally get away with. That's caveat emptor. They're not going to give you the least expensive. They're going to tend to give you the highest commission product, which is certainly not in your best interest. And it's one of those things that the Securities Exchange Commission, the chairman, addressed this in a speech, and I couldn't pass it up because obviously we're investment advisors. We have we are fiduciaries. We are obligated under the law to find the lowest cost way to get the job done for a client. Whereas a financial advisor, and you're going to think this is a little crazy, but they are, under at least traditional common law, obligated to find the most profitable way for their employer and themselves to get the job done, which is the most expensive way for the investor. Now, they can be really nice about it, or they can be not nice about it. That's all beside the point. But it's one of those things that I think is worth noting. Most people that I have talked to, and even people that I have a strong relationship with, who I would have known the difference, there's a world of difference between an investment advisor, a full-time investment advisor, and a person who is a financial advisor. Financial advisor means salesperson, my job is to make a profit off of selling you stuff. Investment advisor is a person who is obligated to give you the best price and operate solely in your best interest. So this is just 2 cents worth. I noticed it was in the Wall Street Journal. I'm glad to see the SEC finally addressing this. Unfortunately, there was a period of time when the SEC decided to allow brokers and security salespeople to call themselves advisors. They aren't advisors. They're salespeople. And they can be good salespeople, and salespeople have a place in the world. But it's just one of those things I saw in the journal and thought, cool, finally we're getting around to it.
We're about out of time for this hour. If you would like to contact us off the air, we have a voicemail during the weekends available locally at
254-947-1111.
You can reach that same voicemail on the weekends, real live people during the week, at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. or tpwc.com, and listen to podcasts, read our philosophy, read our newsletters. You can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com, and we read those and answer them. Until next hour, this is the Personal Wealth Coach.
Your Fox News station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.